You know, the universe around us is huge. It's a lot bigger than just this planet. There's a billion, there's millions and millions of miles of empty space before you even get to another planet. And
they'll put a Starbucks there soon.
Any minute now. And there's some thinking that maybe the universe is completely empty and we're it. And there's other thinking that maybe the universe is full of people who look and talk exactly like us, just like on Star Trek. Mm-hmm. But reality is probably that more like, it's probably not just empty, because why would you have all that room and not put anything in it? And it's probably unlikely that there's people out there that look and talk and act and like us and breathe air just like us, like on Star Trek. So I think the most likely scenario is that there's creatures of an unknown size, shape, and form speaking in language that we can't even hear, because they're probably on a different, like, you know, like dog hearing. You know how dogs mm-hmm. hear a different way than right. we hear? They hear stuff really high. You know how dogs can hear thunder before it gets here? So that's one of the reasons why we asked our next guest to join tonight's program.
Talk about dogs?
Yeah, talk about, no, like the talk Mars about rover. Aliens.
It gets back to the Mars rover, doesn't it?
We're going to get back to the Mars rover in just a minute.
Come on, rover.
Hello, Dr. David Grinspoon. You're on the air with the Chris and Rob Show.
Good evening. How are you guys doing?
Hey, I'm fine. It's my speculation that the universe is probably not empty, and the universe is probably not full of people who look and talk just like us, but that it's full of, like, fire people and ice people and methane people and stuff like that.
Hey, man, you just summed up this book that I've been working on for 3 years in, like, 30 seconds, right. So now I'm a little jealous.
Well, thanks. It's been a wonderful interview, and we'll talk to you in a couple of years when you write another book.
Okay, sounds good.
All
talk
right.
to you then.
See you later. All right, Rob, it's your turn now, Rob.
Have you ever been in a cubicle at NASA next to a guy who was a methane person, if you know what I mean?
Oh, man, I sure have. I spent a lot of years working at NASA research centers, and believe me, there's all kinds.
All right, the name of the new book is called Lonely Planets. We talked to Dr. Grinspoon a couple years ago, you, Chris and Rob, and WAIF devotees may remember, when he had his book out called Venus Revealed. All the science book critics weighed in, said Venus Revealed is the startling work of a staggering young genius, and you should really look out for his next book. And his next book is finally here. He's foisted upon us, Lonely Planets, The Natural Philosophy of Alien Life. What do you mean by natural philosophy of alien life? Isn't science not natural philosophy? Isn't science science,
well,
not philosophy?
I kind of called it the natural philosophy of alien life, because I was hoping that somebody would come along and say, what do you mean natural philosophy? Why aren't you calling it science? So now I'm glad that you asked. But basically, what I'm saying is that we're using science, right, to investigate the question of aliens in the universe, but it's almost really beyond science, because with science you need multiple examples of something to really come to any logical conclusion. But we really have only one example of life, right? One planet with life. Yet we're trying to use science to extrapolate to the rest of the universe. So that's why I'm saying, well, maybe it's not really science yet. I'm not saying it's not worthwhile and that scientists shouldn't think about it, but I'm saying it's natural philosophy, which is what science was, you know, 150 years ago, before science was even invented. So I'm saying that in a way we have to think in this kind of primitive way, where science is mixed up with philosophy. Does that make any sense to all of you guys?
So we are to the aliens what pre-Newtonian earthlings were to where we are now? You think that's where we are?
Exactly, exactly. When I call it natural philosophy, it's a statement of our great ignorance and how we have to have huge humility when we go out and say that we can even come to any conclusion about what life might be out there using our puny, primitive little brains and our puny, primitive little science.
So as far as life on other planets go, we're still waiting for the apple to fall to start the whole thing, to start everything going, huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're doing a lot of interesting stuff with astrobiology. That's what we call it. We NASA scientists these days, the search for extraterrestrial life, we're calling it astrobiology. It's kind of a new name for an old field. And we're doing a lot of cool stuff. I mean, we're exploring the planets. We're studying the history of life on Earth. You know, we're learning a lot of new things about the universe that give us hints about what alien life might be like and where we might find it. But as you say, we're still waiting for the apple to fall. Until we find one lousy little microbe on Mars or somewhere else, we are operating in a complete vacuum of knowledge. You know, so we can speculate all we want, but if anybody tells you they're an expert on alien life, you know, like me, I'm an expert on alien life. Yeah, right. I mean, nobody is, right? Because we just don't know yet.
Our guest is an expert on alien life, Dr. David Grinspoon from NASA. Before we get into the context of what we want to talk about tonight, which is alien life and what it may or may not be, let's talk about what the current headline, which is you got this thing called a Mars rover, and it sat down on a pretty desolate spot of Mars, and it's rolling around taking pictures. What have we learned in the last day and a half or so since the Mars rover actually landed, didn't disappear or blow up like all the other Mars spaceships tend to do, but it actually landed, it's taken pictures, and in the last day and a half, what have we learned from the startling new photographs we've all seen on the internet?
Well, I mean, first of all, I have to say, the most amazing thing so far
is that it landed.
We're there, man.
Yeah, because all the other ones blew up.
Exactly. We've had a lot of trouble. It's not easy landing something on Mars, as we've discovered in the most painful, you know, heartbreaking way you can imagine for the people that work for years on these things. And then there's one moment when it's either there or it's not there. And when it's not there, I mean, you know, it's pretty hard. So it's a huge shot in the arm, and we're all just ecstatic that this damn thing is really sitting there ready to roll on Mars. So what we've learned, I mean, as far as what we're going to learn, it's almost all in the future. The first few pictures, you know, we're starting to get to know the neighborhood where we've landed, and we've already learned some really interesting things about it. It's very, very flat, much flatter than anywhere else we've landed on Mars, and that fits with our hunch before we landed that this might be a dried-up lake bed, which would be really cool if that turns out to be true, you know, because that's, think about a really flat place on Earth, the bottom of a lake that's dried up.
Like Kansas.
But there's also, it's not completely flat. There are these circular pits and hollows that we think might be craters that are mostly filled in with dust and dirt. And, you know, we're already looking around at the rocks and learning things maybe about that geological history just from looking at the rocks, but we haven't started to roll around yet. Mostly what they're doing now is checking out the rover, turning it on, getting it to you know, I mean, these things travel a long way to Mars, more than 100 million miles, and they're folded up in this ridiculous configuration, and they land, and they bounce and bounce and bounce, and, you know, to go from that to being ready to roll across the surface, you have to do a certain amount of checking out your systems, and so that's mostly what's going on now. But those initial pictures tell us that we landed in the kind of place we want to land, where it's flat, there's not a lot of big boulders, it's going to be easy to roll around, and yet there's a lot of interesting rocks to go look at and try to determine something about the history of Mars.
Since you work for NASA, Dr. Grinspoon,
yeah,
do you have an actual role with the team that is doing the investigation on Mars, or are you watching it on TV like the rest of us?
Well, I'm involved in a lot of NASA activities and a lot of space missions. This particular mission, I don't have an official role on. I was actually on the NASA committee that helped formulate the strategy of which this mission is a part of. So I've been an advisor to the program. So I feel a certain amount of pride and personal investment, but I'm not one of the guys who's there right now operating the machinery and, you know, sweating bullets quite as much as they are. So in a certain sense, I'm an observer just like you, but it's part of a community that I'm kind of hooked in with, and, you know, they're all my friends, and, you know, I was really nervous when this thing was coming down because these are my buddies who've been doing this for years, and literally in a moment you learn if a decade of your life has gone into something that just crashed and burned.
Now, you said the Mars rover landed in what some of y'all may believe is a dried up lake bed, but then again, isn't that trying to look for other planets, trying to make them more like Earth? Maybe there never was a lake on Mars, but maybe there was still life, because maybe life on Mars didn't need water. Isn't saying there may have been a lake on Mars, aren't we still trapped into our Earth-centric notions of water and planets for life?
Yeah, maybe they never had water there. Maybe it was beer or champagne or something.
No, you guys are absolutely
Thank
right.
You.
You're pointing out some interesting points. We are applying concepts from Earth to Mars. But, you know, think about it. Those are the only concepts we have, so it would be very hard to invent an entirely new language to talk about Mars. But you bring up a good point that we have to be careful of the sort of biases that we bring just from our experience on this one planet to others. And why do we think it's a lake bed? Well, you know, geologists, you can look at aerial photography from Earth, and you notice certain things that are indicative of flowing water. We see some of those same features on Mars. Now, maybe we're fooled because something else is flowing on the surface that looks like it was water, you know. But a lot of smart people have tried to figure this out, and water is the best candidate we can come up with. But in a certain sense, that's the purpose of this rover, is to test that assumption and see if we're right about this, because we can look directly in those rocks for the chemical signs of water. Now the other thing you mentioned, Kit, could there be some other kind of life that doesn't need water at all? Yes, I think so. And I personally, you know, when I talk about this in my book, Lonely Planets, because, you know, part of what I try to do, and again, part of why I call it natural philosophy, is I try to look at the hidden biases that scientists have, the sort of prejudices that we don't like to admit. And scientists do tend to say, you need water for life. And why do we think this? Well, all life on Earth needs water. And actually, the opposite is also true. All water on Earth has life. So the two are very much linked here. So naturally, we go to another planet like Mars. We see the signs of water. We get excited. We think, hey, there could have been life there. Maybe there still is today in some way that we can't understand. But you're right. That is a prejudice. And in science, we have to be careful of these prejudices, or at least be explicit about them. We have to admit, okay, we're making an assumption here. Maybe we're wrong, but it's the best we can do. And I don't think scientists say that enough. And that's one of the points of Lonely Planets, and the points of calling it the natural philosophy of alien life, is that we need to say that. We need to admit when we don't know, even though scientists are used to kind of copying this attitude of like, hey, we're the masters of the universe. When we're talking about alien life, we're not the masters of the universe. You know, we're at best the little primitive creatures from Earth looking around the neighborhood trying to figure out, you know, what the heck is up.
So you're saying that when we look around our own green, greasy planet for examples of life that we can use as models for life that may or may not have developed elsewhere, there is no life on the planet, whether it be animal, vegetable, or mineral, that is not water-based?
That's absolutely right.
Cactuses don't drink water.
No, they do. Cactuses are very good at hoarding water.
What about camels?
They need very little.
Camels don't drink water.
You know that, man. You're pulling my chain. But everything on Earth, I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing how uniform all life on Earth is. We've tried to find organisms that are different. But fundamentally, they all use DNA. They all use protein. They all need water. We're related to everything, every creature on Earth, no matter how ugly. Name any creature that you wouldn't want to be related to, and we all are related. It's something striking we found about life on Earth, and we've never found anything that could live without water. But that may just be Earth, you know. Who knows?
Well, let's go to the phones, because we got a couple of guys on the phone holding to talk to you. So first we go to Glenn. Hello, Glenn. You're on the air with Dr. David Greenspoon.
Hi, Chris and Rob. How are you?
Fine. Say hi to David.
Oh, hi, David. How are you?
Hi, how you doing?
Great. A couple of questions for you, actually a two-part question. One of the things that concerns me a lot when I look up at the heavens at night is the frequency of asteroids. I'm constantly reading stories on the Internet and in the newspapers about the possibility of an asteroid colliding with the Earth. And clearly, these films that have been produced in the last few years, such as Armageddon and Deep Impact, are simply propaganda to prepare us for the eventuality of an asteroid impacting with Mother Earth. My question to you, sir, twofold. First of all, what is the real probability of an asteroid attacking the Earth, and could these asteroids be motivated to strike our Earth by another society?
Okay, well, those are interesting questions. The first question, what is the real probability that an asteroid will hit the Earth? That's easy. It's 100%. An asteroid will hit the Earth. It's just, when you ask me how soon and how large, of course, that's where we get into the more difficult thing that we're trying very hard to estimate. Just to put it in perspective, 65 million years ago, an asteroid or a comet that was about 10 kilometers across smacked into Earth, wiped out 90% of the species, including the dinosaurs. One of those really big ones probably hits something like every 100 million years. But a smaller one capable of wiping out a city, you know, maybe hits every 10,000 years or so. Not that it's going to necessarily hit a city every time. But as the Earth gets more populated, that gets to be a more dangerous thing. So these things do hit, and they're going to continue to hit, unless, of course, we decide to do something about it.
And what would you recommend?
The interesting thing about the point we're at in evolution right now is that we're just getting to the point where we could do something about it. So the probability may soon reduce to zero if we get smart about that. As far as your second question, which is, could another civilization decide to nail us with an asteroid? Well, I would have to say yes, that's possible. Am I worried about it? No, because I can't imagine why anybody would want to do that. So I think it's possible, but I wouldn't lose sleep over it.
Anything else, Glenn?
No, I thank you for your forthright attempt to answer my question.
Okay, thanks for your call, Glenn.
Nanu.
That means we have a line open at 513-961-8900 in case you want to call in and talk about the cosmos and alien life with our guest, Dr. Greenspoon from NASA. Again, that number is 513-961-8900.
Now, why has Earthlings naturally assumed that there would be life on Mars as opposed to life on Saturn, life on Jupiter, life on Pluto? Is it because it's our neighbor? Is it only because we see it a lot and it's nice and bright red and we can see it all the time?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, and it's certainly true. Humans have been fascinated with the question of life on Mars for a long time, you know, centuries. So why Mars over other planets? Well, it hasn't always been that way, actually. If you look, the 17th century, believe it or not, people were really interested in the idea of life on the other planets. As soon as we realized that they really were other worlds, after Galileo and all that, you know, when we knew there were other worlds, people were obsessed with alien life, and it wasn't just Mars then. It was Venus, Jupiter, Mercury. People thought there was life on all the planets.
Is there life on Uranus?
Not today, thank you.
you knew that was coming sooner or later on our program.
I think you asked me that the last time.
Oh, yeah, surprise.
Sure, you will next time, too. But it's true, especially in the 20th century, it's been Mars mania. That's a good question. One of the reasons historically, I think, is because when you look at Mars with a telescope, you can see features on the surface that shift and move around. And you can see this, you know, with a backyard telescope today. If you look night after night, week after week, year after year, the features move around. And so some people thought that was vegetation. And then, of course, there was Percival Lowell, that brilliant, crazy astronomer the turn of the last century, who reported there were canals on Mars. And a lot of people bought that and thought there was a civilization. And then, you know, that led to H.G. Wells, the War of the Worlds. And there's a long history of science mixed with folklore about life on Mars. And partly, you know, it's the planet next door, and partly it's got this weird surface markings that you can see move around. And now in the modern era of planetary exploration, we realize that in some ways Mars really is the most like Earth in terms of its surface environment. It's not enough like Earth that you or I would really want to go there unless we had a really good suit. But it's got a 24-hour day. It's not so cold there that you can't imagine going with the right equipment. And you know, on the hottest day of summer on the equator of Mars, it gets to be about as warm as it is in Colorado right now as I speak to you, which is about 0 degrees.
Wow.
You know, so it's cold there, even at its hottest, but it overlaps with the temperature range on Earth. So, you know, it's not so extreme that people have not been able to imagine maybe going there someday and imagine maybe something living there that we could discover or that could even come here for a visit, as it has certainly in a lot of good science fiction stories.
So they'd be very hairy then. Unlike, you see Mars Attack or one of those shows, those green guys from Mars are like hairless little frogs, but they probably would be very thickly hairy.
Right, that's really illogical. Or they'd certainly need to have some good kind of natural insulation, wouldn't they? But they're always these skinny little guys, and that maybe makes sense because the gravity, you know, so low. It's one-third gravity. So you could be, a 98-pound weakling and still stand up just fine.
We'll go back to the phone calls. Let me ask you one more question about Mars here, and then we'll grab the next phone call. You guys landed the Mars rover there in that dry lake bed or that flat plain, and I want to know, why didn't you just land the rover right there at the face on Mars, drive that thing right up into his nostril, find out what's in there, and beam it home? Because that's what the people really want to know.
Yeah,
what's up with the face on Mars? It looks like Joe Namath to me, by the way.
Yeah, well, we, you know, we photographed the face with the Mars, with the NGS, the Mars Global Surveyor.
Right, but station. We all know that that's a conspiracy.
Yeah, I've heard that before. You know, there's a really funny picture. I ought to post this on my website, too. In fact, I'm making a list of things that I'm promising to post, so I will tomorrow, which is my friend Jim Garvin, who I went to school with, is now the chief scientist for Mars exploration at NASA, and he actually made a hiking map of the face on Mars, where it's got the whole trail route that you could hike from the base and up, you know, past the mouth and up through the nostrils and everything, and he got the whole topography and what to bring with you when you hike it and how long it'll take, and it's done just like a hiking map, but it's on the face of Mars. So, I mean, there isn't really a huge mystery there, but actually, it would have been a cool place to land and drive around. It's a very interesting part of Mars, but the problem is, actually, we specifically wanted to land places that were very safe. So a place that's flat, that doesn't have a lot of erosion and topography, is the kind of place, you know, because you don't want to just crash your lander into a boulder. And with this thing, we can land in the safe spots and then drive over to the more interesting spots.
You know,
the whole area around the face of Mars would have been hell to land in because it's really rough and eroded.
If you want to, you can just stop towing the party line because we know that they already landed. They, you guys, you NASA guys, already landed at the face of Mars. And you already got pictures of the pyramids and all that other stuff that's there. And we know that it's secret, top secret. You're just not sharing it with the rest of the world.
Right. Well, you know what? You're right. I have been kind of towing a party line, but I figure it's late enough night now, and probably none of my bosses are listening at NASA, right? So I guess I can level with you guys. And the fact is, you know, we blew it up.
Oh, okay.
There was a face, but we didn't want anybody to know about it, so before we went and re-photographed it, we nuked it. And you're hearing it here first, official NASA report. So.
It just looked too ethnic and wasn't Eurocentric enough, was it?
That's right. You know, if it had had the right features, we would have left it alone.
Blow up the nose. All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Chris on the line talking to NASA scientist Dr. David Greenspoon. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Chris and Rob. How you guys doing?
What's on your mind, Chris?
Well, I have, of course, a question for the esteemed doctor there.
How you doing?
Of course, you know, we've got a few landers that are up there now. We got the Beagle and the Spirit, and then Opportunity is going to be coming in at the end of the month. And they're all based around the equator. What is it specifically? I mean, there's like a lot of things that we're looking for up there, you know, geology and soil samples and things like that. How far down on the list is, you know, primitive life? You know, maybe lichens within a rock or whatever you've got. Who knows what's up there? How far down on the list is actual life?
Oh, that's easy. It's at the top of the list. In a certain sense, it's the thing that we care about the most. It's
okay.
The thing that we would be most excited to find if there was a lichen or some kind of life. Now, these MERs aren't specifically designed to look for life. They're more about characterizing the history on Mars of a place where we think that may have once been conducive for life. It's part of a phased strategy that we've devised that has an overall goal of trying to understand if there could be life on Mars or could have been life on Mars in the past. But, you know, we got these great cameras. They're the best cameras ever landed on another planet. I mean, I don't know if you've seen these pictures that just came back today. They're the first ones that really show off the capabilities of these cameras. And these rocks look so real, you could reach out and touch them. So if there's something growing there, we may pick it up. So even though we're not specifically, you know, this mission doesn't have experiments that are specifically designed to find living organisms, one way that we could discover life anywhere is simply to see it, to see something unusual. And believe me, we'll have our eyes open. We'll be looking out for the signs of the unusual. And so as far as priorities of what we would like to find, going back to your original question, I would have to say, you know, that's number one priority, the number one thing that everybody would, you know, would make our, not just our day, but our century, our millennia, if we found a little lichen growing on a rock on Mars.
Nice. All right. And then on the equator, is that because it's going to be the most even temperature throughout the Martian year?
Actually, no, that's true. But the main reason, these things are solar powered, and there's only a narrow band around the equator where there would definitely be enough energy to power them over their lifetime.
Okay. How long are they going to last up there?
The nominal mission plan is for 90 days for each one. If we're lucky, they might last longer. If we're not lucky, they might last shorter. But the basic sort of baseline plan is to operate each one for 90 days.
David, is that first one, I think it's called Pathfinder, is that the one still working?
No, Pathfinder is dead.
How come?
Well,
I mean, the Voyagers are still way out there past Pluto, and they're beaming back, and those things are 30 or 40 years old now.
Yeah, well, I mean, in a certain sense, that they have a much easier task. They're out in space, which you might think is a harsher environment, but the temperature's not changing, and, you know, all they're doing is transmitting a little beep back to Earth once in a while with a little bit of navigation data. The surface of Mars is actually a much harsher environment, in a way, than outer space, because you have that tremendous cycle of temperature between day and night. I mean, like I said, the hottest it gets on the hottest day of summer is something around 0 degrees, but it gets hundreds of degrees colder than that overnight in the winter. And to expect a machine to last for too long through that punishment is, you know, a little bit much.
Anything else, Chris?
I think that's about it.
Thanks for your call.
All right, thanks.
We've got an open phone line. If you would like to call into the Chris and Rob Show on WAIF and talk to our guest tonight, which is Dr. David Greenspoon of NASA. His new book is called Lonely Planets, The Natural Philosophy of Alien Life. Give us a call here at WAIF. The phone number is 513-961-8900.
I have another hypothesis to what happened to all life on Mars.
Yeah, what's that?
You know, because it's really cold here. It's like 8 or 12 here in Cincinnati today.
It's a cold one today.
It's very cold today. If you have vehicles running around Mars and it gets down to minus 200, you're going to use a lot of antifreeze. And that antifreeze is going to leak out all over the planet.
And your point?
It just killed everything.
Oh, because it's poison?
It started with the Martian cats, moved up to the Martian dogs, then eventually the Martian cows.
Yeah, you know, so I suppose when humans go to Mars, which hopefully they will before too long, we ought to watch out for that as well, those toxic waste dumps. That's an interesting theory. I'll have to steal it and publish it in a journal.
Yeah, you might want to go ahead and do that.
Now, when you're sending these little robots up there to Mars and it's as cold as you say it is, sometimes getting to be, you know, 100 degrees below zero or whatever, how do you test those things on Earth? Do you put them in a refrigerator or something?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, they're at JPL, where most of these things are put together, which stands for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is out in Pasadena, California. There are these, you know, different kinds of environment chambers where you can make it really cold, you can lower the pressure, and as much as possible, you try to test out all the components in the real conditions in which they're going to be operated, because, you know, that's the way you catch things, that you don't want to make assumptions about what's going to work. There have been some failures of spacecraft specifically because people didn't do that. A couple really embarrassing ones. I could tell you a story if you want about a really embarrassing failure where somebody did not test something in the right environment before they sent it.
Is this the one about the metric conversion?
This is worse.
Worse? You know the one I'm talking about with the metric conversion.
Yeah. No, that's embarrassing.
What was the name of that mission?
That was the Mars Climate Orbiter mission.
Right, and that's the one where you made up the story that it was a metric conversion error when really things working fine and it's right down there photographing the face on Mars right now.
That is the one, exactly.
Okay, I got you.
Yeah.
No, but what's the story you want to tell us?
Well, okay, this was actually told to me by a friend I made who was in the Soviet space exploration program. And the Soviets had a lot of very successful missions to Venus. They had a terrible record at Mars. They were 0 for 7 on Mars landers. None of them worked. But they, for some reason, they had a great record on Venus. And this was in the, the late 70s. And it was one of the first Venus landers that was going to take color pictures on the surface. And they did not test the lens cap in Venus temperatures. It's very hot down there. It's 900 degrees. And they had a perfectly working camera. They landed successfully on Venus, and the lens cap was supposed to pop off. Instead, it melted and stuck right on the camera, and they never took a picture. But the the amusing part of the story is that, you know, the Russian space program was very military. And these guys, you know, if they made a mistake, they had to worry about their future or being sent off to Siberia or whatever. You know, it was no laughing matter. And so they're sitting there in the control room on the day of this landing on Venus, and the chief scientist is there with, you know, the five-star general in uniform looking over his shoulder. And the general says, you know, can you give me a report on what you've found? And they're looking at these pictures through the melty lens cap. And one of the scientists says, we seem to be stuck in some dark, viscous liquid. And the other one says, yes, it seems we are in deep, and then use the word to describe fecal matter.
Not just the lens cap, but also
exactly. The team was in deep, sticky, viscous liquid.
Before we go to the phone, Dr. David Grinspoon, I have a real basic, simple question for you now. Now, are these Mars rover-type vehicles that are about the size of golf carts are driving around Mars now? One of them is. Another one's going to join it here in a couple weeks.
They're smaller than golf carts, aren't they?
It depends on how deluxe a golf cart you have. You know, if you got the basic, you know, or it's, they're as big as a big, you know, hefty American ride-along lawnmower. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Now, are these things going to scoop up big chunks of Martian rock and Martian boulders in Martian life forms and Martian trees and bring it back to Earth so we can study it?
These ones are not bringing anything back to Earth. But one of the things that one of the long-term goals of our Mars exploration program is to bring samples back. A sample return mission is what we call it. And part of, as I said, these are supposed to be part of like a phased program where every 2 years we send something new. And part of what we're doing now is scouting the terrain to figure out the best place to bring a sample back from. Because when we do bring a sample back, it's going to be hard, it's going to be expensive, and we're going to end up probably just bringing a few grams of material back to study in Earth laboratories. So we want to pick up the right part of Mars. So part of what we're doing now is getting smarter about the Martian surface so that when we go and do that, A, we'll know enough so that we can do it right and have it be successful, and B, we'll pick up the right rock so that we can learn the most.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We've got Bill standing by. Anyone else that would like to call in can call 513-961-8900. Our guest is David Grinspoon from NASA. The new book is about extraterrestrial life called Lonely Planets, The Natural Philosophy of Alien Life. Hello, Bill. You're on the air with Dr. Grinspoon.
Yeah, hi. Great show you guys are doing.
Thanks.
Good evening.
Dr. Dave.
Yeah.
You may have covered some of this. I pick up WAVE in my car, but not when I get home. So I've only got part of the show in my head. I know that you were talking about water on Mars, and there is water on Mars in solid form, isn't there, at the caps?
Ah, maybe there is, maybe there isn't.
Yeah, well, no, we're pretty darn sure.
The prevailing theory is it's whipped cream, right?
Well, I mean, you have to be careful with this kind of science in making a statement about what we know, since we've never been there, but we've got measurements that make us pretty confident that there is indeed, that you are correct, sir. There is ice at the poles of Mars, and now we think we see evidence for lots of frozen ice underneath the surface near the poles, but no liquid water.
Now, one of the things that they've been talking about is they've been looking at the tracks that the whatever you're calling it, the lander has made when it bounced on its balls, so
right.
to speak, and. They're saying that they're not making patterns on the surface that anyone would have expected based upon what they thought the surface was made out of. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know the pictures you're talking about, and I'm actually pulling it up on my computer now because I want to see exactly what you mean. But I haven't heard them talking about how those marks are weird.
Right.
But Tell me what you heard. This is interesting.
Well, I didn't hear very much. I've been out tonight. I taped Nova on the old VCR, and I was going to look at it in a few minutes. But the mission director said they can't for the life of them figure out how it could have made those marks. In all the tests that they tried, it didn't leave marks on the surface, anything like this. So they're completely confused as to what the surface must be made out of.
Wow, that's really cool. I'm having trouble loading that image right now. What you're saying, I mean, it's first of all, just the idea it's very clever, because one of the things that we do with something like this is use all of the information at our disposal, because, you know, we don't get many chances to go to Mars. So we do things like look at the tracks left when we drive around and compare them to tracks on Earth in different kinds of soil, and we can learn some, do some science even from that. So the idea of looking at the spots that the airbags made when they bounced
is brilliant
as far as telling us, hey, what's this stuff made out of? And the idea that, that they can't figure it out is very intriguing to me. I'm sitting here
thinking about Well, actually, maybe giving them a little more credit. They found themselves looking at these marks and thinking, what the hell are those? You know, and then they realized, those must be our marks. Why don't they look like what our marks ought to look like?
Yeah, well, it's a great idea to use that technique. I'm trying to pull up these images right now so I can actually see what you're talking about.
While you're looking for them, I'll ask you another question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Which is, you talked about H.G. Wells and all the fascinations we've had with Martians and being taken over by Martians, but I guess the latest feeling is there's some possibility that we are Martians. That's some kind of life forms on some rocks that got blown off of Mars ended up hitting Earth and started life here. What do you think about that potential?
Oh, I think it's a great idea. I mean, what he's talking about for you other listeners is that there's a recent resurgence in a radical old theory called panspermia. Panspermia is the idea that maybe life on Earth really was seeded from somewhere else in some way. And it's actually an old idea. It was proposed more than a century ago, but it's not been taken that seriously by scientists. But recently we found that there are many rocks on Earth that clearly do come from the planet Mars. And we've learned that pieces of the planets are always falling on each other, because every once in a while they get knocked off in those big asteroid impacts that an earlier caller asked about. You know,
mm-hmm.
those things happen to planets. They get hit, and pieces get knocked off. So we know that bits of Mars are always falling on Earth, and bits of Earth are occasionally falling on Mars. And in the early history of the solar system, this was much more common. The planets were always interchanging material. So the idea that maybe some bacteria, some kind of creature, could ride along on one of these bits of shrapnel between the planets and seed life does not seem that absurd anymore. So if life started on Earth or on Mars, it could have spread from one to the other. And one intriguing conclusion that we have to accept from that chain of logic is that it's possible that we are all Martians. All right, so I agree with you there.
It's just as likely that there could have been some organic compounds from Mars land on Earth as it could have been life might have come from Uranus.
There you go again.
can't stop them, can you?
Marzo crap.
All right, thanks a lot, Bill.
Thank you.
Hey, our guest is Dr. David Greenspoon from NASA. We're talking about alien life. Let's take a quick little break, and we'll come back and talk to David some more and take your calls at the Chris and Rob Show, WAIF Radio, at 513-961-8900. A lot of science books are filled with quotations from famous dead scientists like Sir Isaac Newton and Einstein, people like that. Dr. Grinspoon's book has a quotation from people like Jonathan Richman? What's up with that?
Oh, Jonathan Richman's just, he's one of my faves from way back. And just in general, music is a big part of my life. And just growing up and, you know, I guess in the United States in the time that I did, pop music was something that I was just completely, my brain was pickled in rock lyrics. And they're a big part of the way I think. I can't help it. So when I write about anything, science, space, whatever, I can't help making references to rock and roll lyrics and, you know, just basically whatever. I don't censor myself that much, you know, so you kind of get the raw, weird inside of my mind when you read one of my books.
Yeah, but even then, most people, you know, they're into rock and roll lyrics and they got, you know, their Beatles and their Jimi Hendrix, whatever, but you dug all the way down into Jonathan Richman land.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm from Boston, and he sings about, you know, that song Roadrunner is all about mm-hmm. driving around Boston late at night, and it made a big impression on me. Yeah, so when I grew up and wrote a book, I had to quote it.
Okay, well, here's the song you should have quoted. This is Jonathan Richman on the Chris and Rob Show.
Here come the Martians, and I wouldn't be surprised if they're riding on their Martian bike. And we have to find out right now, what kind of flavor do these Martians like? Here come the Martian Martians, and they're riding on their Martian bike. Well, we have to find out right now, what kind of ice cream do the Martians like? Well, here come the Martian Martians, why stay in such a...